take us back down to Utapau. So we got on that fixed wing Army plane and we were headed back to Utapau, and we're sitting up close to the bulkhead, and that Army captain flying in the left seat, he leaned back and he said, "Man, it's the first time I ever heard," and he was following us on the radio. He said, "It's the first time I ever heard two pilots talking over the radio how to fly the airplane as they were flying the airplane." So, and we did. The whole way up there, we said, "Well, we know we need to do this. We'll hold this much on final. We'll, you know." And in those days, as I tell some of my best friends like Ken, carry a little extra on final for the family, and you'll never regret it. It's hard to get when you need it if you can't get it. So anyway, they took us back down to Utapau, and it was getting late in the evening. And the master sergeant had fueled the rest of the airplanes, the seven, and he said, "They're ready to go." And I said, "Well, if we have a problem cranking and getting airborne," I said, "it's going to be close to dark when we get up to Tok Lee." I said, "We'll get it next thing in the morning." So we came out the next morning, and we were standing there next to 665, which now lives in Sevierville, Tennessee, at the Tennessee Air Museum. And 606, which was mine, which is right here. And it's at Kavanaugh. And I think Mr. Jim Kavanaugh's in the crowd, and I'd like to thank you very much.
Jim, are you here? Where's Jim? There he is, sir.
A lot of time and effort and money went into getting 606 back to where it is today. And thanks to Ken Holston and him being a captain with Delta Airlines, he finagled Delta to repaint 606 back to its original spec. So that's good. You've got an authentic A1 Skyraider in 606.
Wow.
So when we got out to the last two aircraft, 665 and 606, there comes this blue staff car screaming down the taxiway to where we were located. The door slings open, and this lieutenant colonel gets out, and he's from SAC. And so, you know, they do everything by the book, whether it's going to the restroom or whatever, it's by the book. So he comes up to us, and he said, "Wait a minute." He said, "I got a call from headquarters, and they said, they heard you flew these airplanes. They want to know, when did you get current? You can't fly these airplanes. When did you get current in these A1s?" And Jack and I looked at each other and looked back at him and said, "Yesterday." He didn't say a word. He got back in his car and headed out. So we just got in those A1s. And
how many of you active duty were in SAC? Any of you? Yeah, a few.
Nothing against SAC, but that's the way they operate.
Well, I just want to identify my old gang. Somebody.
Yeah. And by the way, I know there's some people here visiting today that worked on the A1, whether you were weapons troops, gas troops, whatever you were, radio. Would you raise your hand? I'd like to thank you.
Yeah. Also, Roger, would you identify John Goldenbaum's over here,
yeah,
with two of your Sandy guys?
This is a little unusual, maybe the first time since we came back from Vietnam. When you go into the A1 squadron, you fly on the wing for a couple of flights, and then you're okay to go up and be Hobo 1, they call it, and you lead a flight of two. After you fly Hobo missions for a while, they upgrade you to Sandy Wingman, whether it's Sandy 4 or Sandy 2. And after you've flown a few Sandy missions and they got a lot of faith in you, they upgrade you to Sandy 1. Sandy 1 is in charge of the whole SAR force, all the Sandys, the Jollies, the forward air controllers. He communicates with the AC-130, Kingbird. I mean, he is in charge of the SAR force. It just so happened that John Goldenbaum, John Ralston, and Cliff Groves and I were in the same flight, and we were all Sandy 1s, qualified flight leads. I'd like these guys to stand up.
Yeah.
Stand up. There you go. Hey, how are you? Good to see you. It was really an honor for you to fly the SPAD and go and pick people up. That was just the greatest. So when we got 6-8-5 and 6:06 off, and we landed at Tock Lee. We pitched out again and landed. And as I saw Goldie rolling out on the runway, I just jokingly said to him, "Are you down?" He said, "Yeah, I just landed, and I'm turning base." And I said, "Well, I guess that makes me flying the last day one in the U.S. Air Force." And I was on base turn. That was a joke. But I do enjoy it so much. And when we came out of there, the State Department had found out what we had done. And they said, "You cannot say that you stole those airplanes from the North Vietnamese. You can say that you repositioned previously U.S.-owned property." So that's the way that was. And they gave Adderholt a hard time. And while Adderholt was running the show, he stole every F-5, every A-37. He took a bread truck with his crew of people with a settling torch and went up and down the line. He cut the guns out of the AC-119 gunships. He cut the dash out of a lot of airplanes that he couldn't do anything with. So if the North Vietnamese were coming to claim their spoils, they were going to get junk. They didn't get jack, except a bunch of wore-out, broke airplanes. So Adderholt was just unbelievable. So in kind of winding it up, when I got through with my tour in 75, he called me in his office and he said, "What do you want to do?" And I said, "I don't know anything but close air support." And he said, "Well, how about an A-7? And they were kind of coming online. And I said, "Sir, that'd be great." So he got me an A-7 to Davis-Monthan. After the A-7, I moved to Myrtle Beach in the A-7. Then I transitioned to the A-10. So I've just been attack below 5,000 foot all my life. And I just enjoyed that. Was in 24 years, and I don't regret a second of it, especially flying 606. When I got back in 75, for some reason, I was at Eglin Air Force Base doing something. And I'd heard that all the refugees, a lot of them, had been relocated to Eglin. They were out on the grass in these 50-man army tents. And I went over there, and I'm not sure why. But I went over there to see those guys that had come back. So I asked, "Do you have these Vietnamese refugees segregated by aircraft?" And they said, "Yes." And so I said, "Well, where are the A1 pilots?" And they gave me a tent number, and there was a lot of tents. So I went down there to that tent. I walked in, and here's about 30 or 40 cots in that tent. It's hot. In typical fashion for Asian pilots and all, they're in their underwear and T-shirt. And they're playing cards on their cots. And that's all they had. So I sat in there and talked to them a little bit. I said, "You know, I flew the A-1 in Saigon for a while, or not in Saigon, but I saw your A-1 in Saigon. And I got to fly the A-1, and then I was involved in you getting out of Vietnam." And so the next day, I went back and I said, "What do I need to do to take one of these guys with me?" And that lady sitting there, she turned this piece of paper around and said, "Sign here." That was about what it took. So I signed off on possibly doing that. So I went to the tent and I found this one that I liked, this guy I was talking to. I said, "You know, you don't know me. I don't know you. But we both flew the A-1. If you want to get out of here, I'll take you with me to live with me." He talked to his buddies. So, okay, I'll go. So I took him in the car. We went straight to the BX. I got a cart and the biggest suitcase. We loaded up, and we headed across country to Tucson, Arizona, where he lived with me for a year. I got him a job at HEB, stocking shelves. I got him a checking account, Bank of America. Got him enrolled in an English class. After a year, he and some of his buds wanted to head out. I said, "Okay." I blessed them. They had bought a car. We went to the bank, got all his money out, got him traveler's checks, shook his hand, and he headed out. And that kind of summed up my tour and my career and what I wanted to do.
Well. Were you able to keep track of him? Could you keep track of him at all, or he
of you? I tried to track him down a few times. I'd heard that, believe it or not, he went to Minnesota, and I think there's a lot of Vietnamese people in Minnesota, and he's probably 40 years plus now, so he's well on his way doing something. But this whole thing happened 40-something years ago, in 5 and 6 May 1975. And probably this story wouldn't have come about had the Smithsonian Air and Space Magazine not published a story about the fall of Saigon. It was labeled Escape to Utapau. You can Google it. And it told the whole story about how it all happened, except some of the minor details I told you about were left out about Jack and I. So I got the phone calls, and they said, well, where are those airplanes? And tell us what happened and all this. And we didn't know anything. So this is 40 plus years. So I started checking around, and thanks to Ken Holston, he calls me one day and he said, Youngblood, there's only 3 Jack Drummonds in the United States. And I didn't know where Jack had gone. And he said, guess what? One of them's in Round Rock, Texas. Well, Round Rock, Texas is 40 miles from my home. So I call him up, and believe you me, when he answered the phone, I knew I had the right number. And he said, hello. And I said, Jack. And he said, Youngblood. And that was pretty much it. So after 40 years, we got back together.